We are going to study the book of Ecclesiastes this evening. We did talk about it this morning in quite a bit of detail, but we're going to talk about it in greater detail tonight. As far as the book itself goes, the name of the book actually means the preacher. It comes from a Hebrew term, Koheleth, which is only found in Ecclesiastes. It's the only place that particular Hebrew word is used. And it can be found in verses 1 and 2, where it says, "The words of the preacher, the son of David, king of Jerusalem, vanity of vanity, says the preacher." And again, it's found in verse 12, down chapter 7, verse 27, chapter 12, verses 8 through 10. All those verses contain that particular word that means preacher. In the Hebrew definition, it means one who addresses an assembly, a speaker who goes before a crowd. The Septuagint, when it translated into the Greek equivalent for that, which was Ecclesiastes, which is a form of the Greek word ecclesia, which we get the word church from, because that means assembly in the Greek. In Latin, is spelled the way we are, in Greek, it's spelled with E-K-K. In Latin, it's spelled E-C-C, but it's pronounced basically the same way, Ecclesiastes. And it means a speaker who speaks before an assembly. So that's where we get the name of the book. The author of this book is not mentioned other than he calls himself the preacher. But the author is Solomon, even though he's not mentioned by name. The reason why we're quite confident about who wrote this book is that he tells us details about himself that only Solomon matches. For instance, in, going back to Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 1, it says, the word of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Okay, so he's a descendant, if you want to take the broadest definition, he's a descendant of David, who was king in Jerusalem. Okay. If we go down then to verse 12, it also mentions, "I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem." Now that particular fact is important, because Israel divided in the days of Rehoboam, David's grandson. And the southern kingdom was known as Judah. The northern kingdom was known as Israel. And when they were whole, they were called Israel. And when they divided, the northern kingdom was known as Israel. So, and the northern kingdom's capital was eventually in Samaria. But it was not in Jerusalem. Judah's capital was in Jerusalem. So if you take a descendant of David, who was king in Jerusalem, over Israel, that leaves two. There's only Solomon and Rehoboam. And Rehoboam only part of his reign, for that matter. Only Solomon for his full reign and Rehoboam for part of his reign. However long it took him to end up causing division in the kingdom. Those are the only two that reigned over Israel in Jerusalem. They were sons of David. Descendants of David. We also have in that description, in verse 16, says, "I said to myself, behold, I have magnified increased wisdom more than all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my mind had observed a wealth of wisdom and knowledge." He had more wisdom than anybody else that came before him. Now the two that you can only name, you got Solomon and Rehoboam. I don't think any of us would put Rehoboam in the category of being smarter than Solomon was, or having more wisdom than Solomon had, since he managed to split the kingdom. So we're down to just one, and that's Solomon himself. In addition to that, it matches what Solomon, the Bible says about Solomon in 1 Kings chapter 3, and in verse 12. Hold your fingers in Ecclesiastes, we'll be back there, but 1 Kings chapter 3, and in verse 12, "Behold, I am done according to your words. Behold, I have given you a wise and discerning heart, so that there has been no one like you before you. nor shall one like you arise after you. Now notice, Solomon is in a special class all by himself. His wisdom was going to be such that there was going to be no one like him before or after. Now the king that's stated here says, or he calls himself the preacher, says, I had more wisdom than everybody else before me. Well, if you want to say it was some other king, anyone of the lineage of David, other than Solomon, then you have to claim that that king was wiser than Solomon and that God didn't keep his word. And it doesn't fit. There are also lists of accomplishments in this book that the preacher accomplished. In chapter 2, verses 4 through 6, it says, I enlarged my works. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards for myself. I made gardens and parks for myself. I planted them, all kinds of fruit trees. I made ponds and water for myself with which to irrigate a forest of growing trees. And it goes on to describe. These match very much what Solomon was known for. The reason why Rehoboam ended up splitting the kingdom was because Solomon had so many building projects going on. The tax burden was so heavy that the people came to him and said, we need a decrease in taxes. And Rehoboam said, hey, you haven't seen anything yet. And that's why they decided, hey, we're leaving. Also in the same chapter, in verse 7, it says, I bought female slaves, and I had home-born slaves that possessed flocks and herds larger than all that preceded me in Jerusalem. I also collected for myself silver and gold and treasures of kings and providences. I had made for myself male and female singers and the pleasure of men, many concubines. This, again, all matches what we know about Solomon. Solomon's wealth was incredible. And the amount of stuff that he had was fascinating. Passages in the scripture tell us about what the monthly food budget basically was. And it was astronomical. The amount of income that was coming in was phenomenal. In fact, one verse basically says that, gold and silver were just basically common items because there's so much of it around, especially silver. There's also another mention that makes it, we know that it has to be Solomon, is in chapter 12. And by the way, all the other kings after Solomon, they never even came close to approaching his wealth. They constantly ended up having to pay tribute to various foreign nations because they kept rebelling. And so they never obtained the wealth that Solomon had. They lost most of it over the years. But in Ecclesiastes 12 and in verse 9, it says, in addition to being a wise man, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, and he pondered and searched out and arranged many proverbs. This is something also we know about Solomon. He wrote a lot of proverbs, 3,000 to be exact. And we also know he was a collector of proverbs. And this matches, again, what we know about Solomon. Now, one of the difficult parts, though, of Ecclesiastes is there's really no mention of any historical events in Ecclesiastes. So it doesn't tell us when in Solomon's reign this particular book was written. Other than it certainly wasn't at the beginning of the reign because he talks about how many accomplishments that he had gained. It could have been in the middle, it could have been towards the end, we just don't know. Now, if you were to pick one word out of all this book to describe the book, probably the one that most likely would come to people's mind is the word vanity. Because that's what's repeated so many times. And as we mentioned it before, vanity is the idea of something being useless. In particular, it's the idea of blowing in the wind and thinking you're going to make some impact by blowing. Or try to grasp the wind and think you can hold it and change its course. It's just something you can't do. You can work at it all you want. It's absolutely useless, worthless work. That's what vanity is. Now, we mentioned before, this is one of the books of the wisdom literature. Job teaches us how to suffer. David's book, mostly, but Psalms, teaches us how to pray and how to worship God. Proverbs told us how to live, how to act righteously. And Ecclesiastes is actually a book that tells us how to enjoy life. Because it's addressing the question, what is the meaning of life? And at first it seems like an odd thing to say that this book is about how to enjoy life when it labels so many things as being useless. Because so many people focus on the negative themes, they miss the fact there's a lot of positive themes that are being developed in this book as well. What Solomon notes at the beginning of the book is the world contains endless cycles. And he wanted to know, given that, what impact does a person have in the world? In verse 3, we already read verses 1 and 2. Verse 3, it says, Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 3. What advantage does a man have in all his work which he does under the sun? That's the question. What profit, what gain is there in everything that a person does? Why are we here? In verses 4 through 7, it says, a generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Also, the sun rises and the sun sets, and hastening to his place, it rises there again. Blowing toward the south and then turning towards the north, the wind continues swirling along. On its circular courses, the wind returns. All the rivers flow into the sea, yet the sea is not full, to the place where the rivers flow, and there they flow again. Basically, what he's asking is, look at all the things that just keep going and going and going. They can come right back to where they start. What difference are we making in this world? What kind of impact do we as people make? Since everything just keeps going back to where it starts. In verse 8, he notes, all things are wearisome. Man is not able to tell it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. Basically, he's asking, what satisfaction is there in drawing from life? How do you live life here and find satisfaction, contentment, being able to say, that was a life worth living? Verses 9 and 10, he says, that which has been is that which will be, and that which has been done is that which will be done. So there's nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one might say, see, this is new? Already has existed for ages, which was here before us. In other words, he's asking, how are people made better because I'm alive? What impact have I done that improves mankind or improves the world? And in verse 11, he says, there is no remembrance of earlier things and also the later things which will occur. There will be no remembrance for them among those who will come later still. Again, the answer to the question is, what impact am I making on life? Will there be any remembrance? Will there be any lasting impact? Or will it be forgotten? Now, the book itself is written in a style of a research paper, strangely enough. It has exactly the same format we still use today in research papers. It starts out with a description of the problem, and that's given at the beginning, which is what we just read from verses 1 through 11. Then there's a proposal on how you're going to go about researching the problem. You state, okay, here's what I see as a problem. Now we've got to state how we're going to solve it or look at this problem. How are we going to analyze it? And that's what he does starting with verse 12. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I set my mind to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that was done under heavens. It is a grievous task which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with. I have seen all the works which have been done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after the wind. So basically what he says, he's going to do it by wisdom. and his own observations. I've seen all this been going on. I've been granted great wisdom. I'm going to look at this problem and try to figure out what it is that God has us here for. Now, in any good research, you also have to state what your limitations are. You can't do everything. And Solomon understands, too, that even in looking at this problem, he's not going to be able to give you every answer to those questions. There are going to be limits to what he can observe and limits to what he can do. And he states these, starting with verse 15, he says, "What is crooked cannot be straightened, and what is lacking cannot be counted." He basically says, I can't fix the world. If it's broken, I can't fix it. If there's something missing, I can't put it there in its place. Verse 16, I said to myself, behold, I have magnified and increased wisdom more than all that were over me in Jerusalem before me, and my mind has observed a wealth of wisdom and knowledge. And I set my mind to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I realized that this also was a striving after the wind, because in much wisdom there is much grief, and increasing knowledge results in increasing pain. Wisdom's not the answer. I'm going to use wisdom to analyze this problem, but wisdom's not the answer, because the more wisdom you have, the more you realize how much you don't have. And the more you see things accurately, the more you realize how much difficulty we're in. So wisdom's not the answer directly. Then what he does is, if you have a research paper, you start doing experiments. And you try things, and you see the results, and you analyze it, and you say, okay, here's some preliminary conclusions. That's what happens from chapter 2 all the way through chapter 11, up to verse 8. And then when you get to verse 9, chapter 11, down through the end of chapter 12, he gives you his conclusion. Here's the summary. Here's what I learned from all these observations, from all these experiments. Here's the conclusion of the matter. Now, we had a handout for you, and one side of it talks about what life isn't about. And basically, that's what we're going to go through. We're going to go through looking at all the things that Solomon looked at, and there's a whole long list of things that he says are vanities. These are things that are just plain useless. In verse 1 of chapter 2, he says, I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure. So enjoy yourself, and behold, it was futility. Having fun, having pleasure, saying life is just a big joke. That's not what life is about. That's useless. We mentioned why this morning. Because how long does fun last? It lasts as long as you're doing it. Well, what happens when you stop? It's gone. Well, what kind of impact is that? How does that make something different? How does that change the world? The answer, it doesn't. He also got involved in a lot of projects. He made a lot of things. Take a look at verse 11. I considered all the activities which my hand had done and the labor which I'd exerted, and behold, all was vanity and striving after wind, and there was no profit under the sun. You can make a whole bunch of things, but it's going to fall apart eventually. You can get, you know, all those fountains that Solomon built and all those gates, you know where they're at right now? They're just dusty relics, if you can find any of them left. They fell apart. That's the way all our building projects are in this world. Most things only last our lifetime before we have to repair it already. That's too a vanity. So making things isn't the answer. He looked at, starting with verse 14, the wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Yet I know that one fate befalls them both. Then I said to myself, as the fate of the fool, it will also befall me. Why then I have been extremely wise? So I said to myself, this too is vanity. For there is no lasting remembrance of the wise man as with the fool, inasmuch as in the coming days all will be forgotten. And how is the wise man and the fool are like die? So I hated life for the work which had been done under the sun, was grievous to me because everything was is futility and a striving after wind. So basically he's looking at education, getting smarter. Is that what life is about, for us to get as smart as we can? He says, well, the problem is it doesn't change anything. You're still going to die. You haven't improved yourself beyond the foolish person, in that sense of the word. And so he says that also, it doesn't make a lasting impact. Not by itself. Starting with verse 18, he says that I hated all the fruit of my labor for which I labored under the sun, for I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who will know whether he will be a wise man or a fool? Yet he will have control over all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored by acting wisely under the sun. This too is vanity. Therefore I can completely despair of all the fruit of my labor for which I labored under the sun. When there is a man who has labored with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, then gives his legacy to one who has not labored for them. This too is vanity and a great evil. He said, now look, I accumulated all this wealth. And he was right, by the way. You take a look at all the wealth that Solomon accumulated. What happened to it? It disappeared under Rehoboam. Real fast. And the rest of the kings struggled thereafter. All that work that Solomon put into building all that wealth, gone. That's a vanity too. So accumulating wealth is not the answer. Starting with verse 22. For what does a man get in all his labor and in his strivings which he labors under the sun? Because all his days and his task is painful and grievous. Even at night his mind does not rest. This too is a vanity. So what he's basically saying, working hard where you just work constantly. Where you just put everything into it and you just never even stop. You even start dreaming about it. He said that's worthless too because it's just a life full of pain. Verse 26 of chapter 2. He says, for to a person who is good in his sight, he has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, while to the sinner he has given the task of gathering and collecting so that he may give to the one who is good in God's sight. This too is vanity and striving after wind. There is no reason to live a life of sin. Because a sinner doesn't survive very long, and all his wealth ends up going to somebody who's good. So he rules that one out real quick. In chapter 3, down in verse 18. I said to myself concerning sons of men, God has surely tested them in order for them to see that they are but beasts. For the fate of the sons of men and the fate of beasts is the same. As one dies, so the other dies. Indeed, they all have the same breath, and there is no advantage for man over beast. For this, too, is all is vanity. All go to the same place, all come from the same dust, and all return to the dust. There's a lot of people that think life is about living for the moment, which is how an animal lives. It doesn't think about the future. It doesn't think about the past. It just lives for the moment. It follows whatever impulses it has. Maybe we should just live like beasts. That's what life's about. And the answer is no. It certainly doesn't give you any advantage. Animals die. Guess what? So do we. Now what advantage is that? So trying to model your life after animals is not the way to go either. In chapter 4 and verse 4, I have seen that every labor and every skill which is done is the result of rivalry between a man and his neighbor. This too is vanity and a striving after wind. Trying to be the best at anything. Trying to live your life so that you are the best, you're the number one in your particular field. That competitive edge. Solomon says that's a vanity. And the reason for it is eventually somebody else is going to be better than you. There's no way you can retain that title. There's always going to be somebody else who's going to be better. So that's too, it doesn't last. So he goes to the other extreme, verse 5. The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. Okay, I won't do anything then. I'll just be lazy. That's what life's about, just not do anything. He said, no, it's self-destructive. That doesn't work either. Starting with verse 7, then I looked again at vanity under the sun, and it was there was a certain man without dependent, having neither a son nor a brother, yet there was no end to all his labor. Indeed, his eyes were not satisfied with riches, and he had never asked for what whom I am laboring and depriving myself of pleasure. This too is vanity and a grievous task. There are some people who say, I'm going to go it alone. I'm going to be Mr. Independent. I'm not going to be dependent on anybody. I'm just going to work for myself. And you know what those type of people end up doing? Putting in a whole lot of work because they're not responding to anybody. There's no reason to stop working. You can see that all the time when people end up, when there's no family member, somebody they called on, they end up a lot of times working a whole lot of hours. And he says, have you ever thought, well, who are you working for? Because you're spending all your time at work, you're not enjoying what you're doing. He said, that too is a vanity. Verse 13 addresses another one. A poor yet wise lad is better than an old and foolish king who no longer knows how to receive instruction. For he has come out of prison to become king, even though he was born poor in his kingdom. I've seen all the living under the sun throng to the side of the second lad who replaces him. There's no end to all the people, to all who are before them, and even to the ones who will come later, will not be happy with him, for this too is vanity and striving after wind. I'm going to be rich and powerful. I'm going to be famous, and people are going to flock to my name. You might make your 15 minutes of limelight, but it's not going to last because people are fickle. And you might become famous, you might become powerful, and next year you're a has-been. Just ask some of the Hollywood stars. It happens all the time. That's not the way it goes. Or at the political giants. Eventually the current president is going to be a has-been. It happens to every one of them. It's the way life is. Chapter 5, verse 7. For in many dreams and in many words there is emptiness. Rather fear God. Here's another one. A lot of people spend their time dreaming, making plans, daydreaming. Life is not about daydreams. You can daydream all you want. You're not going to accomplish anything. That can't be what life is about. Verse 10. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money. He who loves abundance with his income, this too is vanity. It's not about being wealthy. And the way he proves it is, okay, say you get $1 million, guess what's going to happen? You're not going to be happy with $1 million. You're going to try getting more. And when you get more, guess what? You're still not going to be happy, you're going to try to get more. And so that too is a vanity. You'll never reach a time when you say that's enough. Chapter 6 goes along a similar theme. There is an evil which I've seen under the sun and is prevalent among men. A man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor so that his soul lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God has not empowered him to eat from them, for a foreigner enjoys them. This is a vanity and a severe affliction. Not being able to enjoy what you have. That too is not what life is about. Having things and not being able to enjoy is not what God intended. Chapter 6, verse 3, it says, if a man fathers 100 children and lives many years, however many they be, but his soul is not satisfied with good things, and he does not even have a proper burial, then I said, better the miscarriage than he, for it comes to futility and goes into obscurity, and his name is covered in obscurity. Pick anything you want that you want to succeed in. Like how many kids you end up raising. You have 100 descendants underneath you. If you don't get satisfaction from that, it's not worth it. If you don't enjoy, it's not worth it. If you are not content with what you have, it's not worth it either, no matter how much you have. Verse 9. What the eye see is better than what the soul desires. This too is futility and a striving after the wind. Wanting things. There are a whole bunch of people that want nothing else. Desire is not what life is about. Because you're never satisfied yet again. Verse 10, and whatever exists has already been named and is known that what man is, for he cannot dispute with him who is stronger than he. For there are many words which increase futility. What then is the advantage to a man? He's talking discovering something new. There's a lot of people that think life is all about finding something nobody else ever found before. Being able to first one to name it. It's brand new. Problem is, tomorrow is old hat. And so what advantage did you get? Yeah, it may have been new temporarily, but it's not new anymore. Chapter 6, verse 12. For who knows what is good for a man during his lifetime, during the few years of his futile life? He will spend them like a shadow, for who can tell a man what will be after him under the sun? There are some people who think that life is about having plans. If I get my whole life mapped out, road maps plotted out, and I know everything that I'm going to do, I'm going to make it. The problem is, nobody knows what the future is like. I don't care how well you got your next 20 years mapped out, it ain't going to be the way you think it's going to be. Something's going to go wrong. And then what use was all those plans? Going to chapter 7, verse 6. For as the crackling of thorn bushes under a pot, so is laughter of the fool. This too is futility. Just being foolish. Living dumb. Just making sport of everything. That's not what life is about. Chapter 7, verse 15. I've seen everything during my lifetime of futility. There is a righteous man who perishes in righteousness. There's a wicked man who prolongs his life in his wickedness. Do not be excessively righteous and do not be overly wise. Why should you ruin yourself? Do not be excessively wicked and do not be a fool. Why should you die before your time? Basically what he's saying is life is not about perfectionism. You can't. If you make your life go, you say life is all about being absolutely perfect, you'll never make it. Because every one of us flub it. And if you want to go to the other end of the scale and say, hey, I'm going to just live as wickedly as I possibly can, you're going to shorten your life. Either way, it won't work. Along that with it, in chapter 8, verse 10, so then I've seen the wicked buried, those who used to go in and out from the holy place, they are soon forgotten in the city, where they were thus, this too is futility. To be wicked, the sin, is useless. People forget the sinners. Oh, yeah, there are a few of them who can keep their names around for a little while. They can become infamous. But for the most part, people forget sinners. You don't remember the name of the thief that got shot last week. That's old news. Chapter 8, verse 14. There is a futility which is done on the earth, and that is that the righteous men to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked. On the other hand, there are evil men to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. I said that this too is futility. If you expect justice out of life, if you expect life to be fair, sorry, that's not what life is about. Life isn't fair. Life isn't always just. And that's not what life is about either. Chapter 11, we're going to jump a little bit. And in verse 8, he says, "Indeed, if a man should live many years, let him rejoice in all of them. Let him remember the days of darkness, for they will be many. Everything that is to come will be futility." Expecting to live a long life and never, ever have any sorrows. That's a useless thing, because there are going to be hardships. You're going to face griefs. You're going to cry. If you think life is about not having problems, forget it. That's a useless, vain goal. And one last one in verse 10 of chapter 11. "So remove grief and anger from your heart and put away pain from your body, because childhood and the prime of life are fleeting." You think you're going to stay young forever? Sorry. We all grow old, unless you die. Either way, it doesn't help. It's not going to make an impact in life. And it took me a long time just to tell you what life isn't about. So I'm going to hold off till next week to tell you what life is about. So you just have to come back to part two. We've got to understand, a lot of people these things usually shock people. Because these are things people think life is about. They chase it after it. They spend most of their life doing it. And they wonder why they're not happy. And so Solomon very well explains, and that's why people are upset with this book sometimes, and why they think it's a book about vanity, is because he does such a thorough job to tell you why these things are just plain not what life is about. And it's all the things we want life to be about. But there are things that we ought to focus on. As we mentioned before, you know, at the end of the book it says, "Serve God and keep His commandments." That's what the sole purpose God made us for. There's a chance here tonight that if there's anyone here who is not yet a child of God, that they can become one and start serving God, because that's what life is about. And it gives meaning and purpose to your life. If there's anyone here is a child of God, like the prayers of the brethren on behalf, why don't you come forward and we stand and sing the song of the selection.